You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, August 3rd, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ross Barkin, writer of the Substack Political Currents by Ross Barkin, and author of The Prince, Andrew Cuomo, Coronavirus, and the Fall of New York. And not so coincidentally, New York State Attorney General's report. Andrew Cuomo sexually harassed multiple women, some who are still working in his office. Tried to retaliate against one for going public. Meanwhile, New York City will require proof of vaccination for most indoor activities, as Florida breaks the record for COVID infections, and Arkansas's hospitals are at full capacity. Meanwhile, Cori Bush still sleeping on the steps of the Capitol. Increasing pressure over the eviction moratorium as landlords rush to throw their tenants out. Lindsey Graham has breakthrough COVID, and he may have spread it on Joe Manchin's houseboat, not The Onion. Preliminary National Labor Relations Board assessment. Amazon illegally discouraged votes during the Bessemer union drive. We have key special elections in Ohio today. Nina Turner's primary happening. And lastly, a new poll shows 65% of Texans support a federal vaccine mandate. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Joined by Emma Vigeland. Emma, how are you? I'm a little tongue-tied this morning.
Yeah,
I don't know what it is.
Happy Mon Tuesday to you.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. Happy Mon Tuesday.
And we should say thank you to Brendan for having some sort of premonition that this news about Cuomo would break today, because our guest is quite apt.
That's right.
He booked
we always nail it.
Ross for us today.
Yeah, we always nail it.
Right, always.
Always nail it.
Especially with the tech.
Yeah. More or less. So we're still in this sort of a weird period, trying to see where we're going to end up with both the so-called bipartisan infrastructure bill and the reconciliation. This has got to be wrapped up in the Senate, at least parts of it, by the end of next week. So we will start to see some more activity quite shortly. In the meantime, there's still massive fallout. And in fact, we're just beginning to see there's massive political fallout. We're just about on the precipice of seeing the material fallout of the Biden administration's bungling at best of the eviction moratorium. We went through all of the details yesterday in terms of how we got here. And there's a real sense now that the Biden White House is trying to bail water, but there are few options for them at the moment. Meanwhile, Cori Bush, one of the newest members of the House, certainly the newest member of the Justice Democrats, or one of them, I should say, has been literally camping out on the Capitol steps for 4 nights now.
Punch Bowl opens their piece on this topic with Representative Cori Bush's winning.
And
what a sentence.
Right. And Punch Bowl, we should just say, is this sort of like insidery,
right,
Politico type.
Although, I mean, I would imagine that she doesn't see herself as winning, because the fact that she has to be in this position is something that should have been avoided altogether.
Absolutely. But she is bringing attention to this situation, and I guess, and you know, this is the dilemma that you have if you are a first term, you could argue a second term, a congressperson. She could have done this 3 weeks ago and no one would have paid attention to it, and they would have just been like, what is she doing, and it's useless and it's silly. And then the timing of it, and they would have been like, well, we're getting to it.
Right.
But
the outrage, I think, adds a little punch.
And the fact that the moratorium has expired,
right,
and we are now seeing all sorts of reports of both community organizations that help renters be inundated by phone calls yesterday, and courts getting slammed with legal filings to evict people. Here is Cori Bush on the steps of Capitol Hill yesterday.
No, not really. She, my whole point for not going up to talk to her she is
responding to a question about a conversation she had with the Vice President Kamala Harris. All right, continue.
No, not really. She, my whole point for going up to talk to her was I wanted to look her in her face. I wanted her to look me in my face. I wanted her to see my eyes and to look down into my soul if she could see it, because I don't want my people. I do not want the people of St. Louis ending up on the street because of policy choices, because of failed leadership, because of passing the buck. I need my people whole and I need my people safe. St. Louis deserves that. And not only St. Louis, but all across this country, people need that. And so that's what we did. I asked her, I said, look me, I said, I need you to see my eyes. You know, my people cannot be put out on the street, you know, and she nodded, you know, and she, you know, told me to take care of myself, and you know, she's working. Yeah, she said they're working, and I do believe.
Well, she's got to say that.
I guess we'll see. That you don't know, you don't believe that she doesn't believe, or
you know what doesn't constitute. No. I mean, I don't believe Kamala Harris. You know what doesn't constitute working? Like, say you're in class and you do a class project, and or you have an assignment that's due on a Friday and then you realize you didn't do it and then you scramble over the weekend to put it together to bring it in on Monday. Like, that doesn't necessarily constitute that you've been working on that project.
And
because
it's
already
argue,
been due. It's right. Already been due, and everyone else has been graded.
If you're trying to get your folks to send in a note saying that you were sick,
well, that's why
you didn't get it done. That's also working.
We've all tried that, but I don't think that necessarily applies in this case.
Well, I don't know. Here's Gene Sperling, basically doing. He is one of the White House on the economic team. Here he is, basically doing that, trying to assure the press that something's going to happen.
Given the rising urgency of the spread of the Delta variant, the president has asked all of us, including the CDC, to do everything in our power to look for every potential legal authority we can have to prevent evictions.
Yeah. Now, the problem is, of course, he then goes on to say basically, like, you know, let the states need to figure this out. They knew what the plan was weeks ago. They just made a decision to just blow it off. We know that it was, I mean, honestly,
They don't want to do anything.
I mean, there were people in there who wanted to extend it, according to the reporting. White House lawyers said that if you do that, you risk the Supreme Court rolling things back even more. Now, we mentioned that with Dan yesterday. You know, you can be skeptical or not skeptical as to those legal assessments. But if that was the assessment, then they should have brought this up with Congress 3 or 4 weeks ago.
But were they going to go back in time? They could do what the Republicans do. Do it anyway, and if it gets challenged at the Supreme Court, you buy extra weeks and months for the people who are getting evicted right now. Okay, you say the conditions of the pandemic have changed. Fine, that's like the justification that they need to ensure people have housing. Okay, we don't want to spread COVID because we're worried about the economy. Great, that's like their neoliberal justification. Fine. Use that, allow the CDC to extend the moratorium, and then deal with it down the line. The Supreme Court can't go back in time and then evict people in the months that this protected them. It's such BS. They just are scrambling at the last minute because they want to kick the can down the road, and now they're getting blowback from it, and they don't want to deal with it, which is one of the through lines of this administration thus far.
All right. Well, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Ross Barkin about the Prince. That would be, of course, Andrew Cuomo. In the meantime, today's program is sponsored in part by Native Deodorant. Well, actually, they got a whole line of products now at nativedeo.com/majority report. Did I mention the other day, like what's happening with Milo's birthday on the air?
I don't know if you did on the air.
Okay. Well, the long and short of it is I'm hosting a bunch of her friends at my house overnight for 2 nights. And I'm terrified. The anxiety is amazing because there's such a mass of people in a small place.
Yeah. And they're teens.
Literally the one thing that she said was, could you get more of that Native body wash? The lime and sugar.
Only the best for
I'm
her
like,
friends.
I'm like, wait, that's it. Okay. Well, I handle everything else, but that was the only specific requirement that she had.
Right.
She loves it. You know, sometimes life stinks. But of course, you don't have to because Native has your back. Native cares about the products you put on your body. They're all about stopping the stink the right way. I've spoken in the past about Native's legendary aluminum-free deodorant and how for a long time, extended period of time in my life, I did not use deodorant because I did not want stuff like aluminum and all the garbage that's in there seeping into my body. But Native has none of that. They also have body wash, toothpaste, and their brand new mineral-based sunscreen. Native's broad-spectrum SPF 30 sunscreen is lightweight, absorbs quickly, and you can choose between unscented or coconut and pineapple. I will tell you, I've also had good results with this and putting it on Saul's face without him getting really, really whiny. He gets whiny, but not really, really whiny because greasy.
I've got to get this because I think that might have been what caused my sty.
Oh, really?
I use that spray on my eyelids, the like cheap stuff from CVS.
That.
No, so there you go.
You can get their deodorant and their body wash in amazing scents like coconut and vanilla, citrus herbal musk, lavender and rose, and of course the lime and sugar that is apparently the favorite of my daughter. You can even build your own personalized product bundles. You can mix and match 3 of your favorite scents. You keep them on rotation. You have something for every occasion. Check it out. Stay fresh, stay clean with Native by going to nativedeo.com/majority report or use the promo code majority report at checkout and you get 20% off your first order. That's nativedeo.com/majority report or use the promo code majority report at checkout for 20% off your first order. Also, today's program sponsored in part by ExpressVPN. Why would you want ExpressVPN? Well, using the internet without ExpressVPN is like driving without having any car insurance. Why would you take the risk? I just did a long interview, actually, with fascinating story about the tremendous amount of fraud coming from international crime rings on unemployment. This came up a little bit with Dayan. I'm not quite sure if it did yesterday. But and part of it is because they have stolen people's information from online. And it makes it much easier for them to do this. Every time you connect to an encrypted network, whether it's at a cafe or a hotel or airport, or, you know, they've got them around the city now, any hacker on the same network can gain access to your personal data. Maybe it's your passwords. Maybe it's your financial details. They find the password to your email, and then they start going to different accounts to see if that's the formula that gets them in. Doesn't take much technical knowledge to hack somebody, just some cheap hardware. Honestly, a 12-year-old could do it. Certainly with this generation. Hackers can make up to $1,000 per person selling personal info on the dark web. That was also part of that story. Apparently, a lot of that was happening on Telegram. They would set up these sort of forums where they would sell, like, here's how you get a fake unemployment, and I can sell you the personal data that you can use. Mm. ExpressVPN acts as an online insurance, basically, for you. Creates secure, encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet so hackers can't steal your personal data. It'd take a hacker with a supercomputer over a billion years to get past ExpressVPN's encryption. And by that time, you're so old. You don't
care.
ExpressVPN is simple to use on all your devices. You just fire up the app, and seriously, this takes one click of one button, and you're protected. Secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/majority. That's expressvpn.com/majority. You can get an extra 3 months free. expressvpn.com/majority. And lastly, as soon as I saw this, it almost broke my heart because I was hungry this morning. And I realized we have run out of Magic Spoon, which is my way of saying this final sponsor on today's program, Magic Spoon. Everybody's trying to eat better, but a healthy breakfast does not have to taste like cardboard and be boring. Magic Spoon has the amazing flavors you love, but without all the bad stuff. Yes, folks, cereal. Magic Spoon cereal has 0 grams of sugar, has 13 to 14 grams of protein, only 4 net grams of carbs, and 140 calories in each serving. It is keto-friendly. It is gluten-free. It is grain-free. It is soy-free. It is low-carb, and it's delicious. You can build your own box, send it 4 at a time, or you can get a variety pack with available flavors like cocoa, fruity, frosted, peanut butter, blueberry, and the Sam Cedar favorite, cinnamon. Magic Spoon is bringing back 2 popular flavors, too, cookies and cream and maple waffle, permanently, much to the applause of my children, who are huge cookies and creams fanatics. Mm. I would also like to vote, because I know these guys listen to the ads sometimes, for a full-time peanut butter and cocoa, because that mix, I've mixed them together myself, but when they mix it, for somehow they find the perfect...
peanut butter and chocolate, can't go wrong.
Exactly. Folks, do yourself a favor. Go to magicspoon.com/majority report. Grab your delicious cereal and try it today. Be sure to use the promo code Majority Report at checkout, and you'll save $5 off your order. Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it is backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember, get your next delicious bowl of guilt-free cereal at magicspoon.com/majority report and use the code Majority Report to save $5 off. Thank you, Magic Spoon, for sponsoring this episode and my tomorrow's breakfast. I'm not going to make the mistake 2 days in a row. All right. Want to welcome to the program Ross Barkin. He is the proprietor and writer at Substack Political Currents by Ross Barkin, and author of book which just came out, The Prince, Andrew Cuomo, Coronavirus, and the Fall of New York. Ross, I'm here with Emma Vigeland. Welcome. I imagine you're going to be a little busy today.
Yes, breaking news, long anticipated news. So yes, I'm catching up as we speak and digesting it along with everyone else. So yes, this is definitely a very important day for the state of New York and, you know, for millions of people. Arguably.
Yeah, it's absolutely, I mean, this report seems pretty stunning. And we should remind people, right? Andrew Cuomo wanted this investigation. I mean, or at least publicly said he did.
Well, yes. I mean, publicly he said that. I mean, privately he'd prefer no accountability of any kind. So publicly, yes, he called for due process, which is fair. I support due process personally. And there were people calling for him to resign out of the gate based on the sexual harassment allegations. And I think there was an argument that let the investigation play out, let the investigators do their job, and let's see what they find. And today is that day. And what we've seen so far, and my caveat is I haven't had a chance to read the 165 pages in total. I've looked at some of it. I've covered it and read the press reports and everything. You know, it substantiates basically everything. You have multiple sexual harassment allegations that were substantiated, physical touching in addition to lewd comments. James and her investigators were very pointed about the culture that Cuomo facilitated and possible violations of state and federal law in terms of both the harassing and also how the complaints were handled and the retaliation that apparently went into this, which again, none of this is a surprise if you followed Cuomo, been following this to any degree. It just confirms what many of us suspected. And now we will see what happens next, and a few different things can happen.
Is it accurate that there's a recommendation for criminal prosecution in one of the incidents?
It's actually a good question. There could be. I'd have to double check on that. I'm still getting caught up myself on that. I don't know for certain if this will turn into something criminal. You know, that would be the next step with all of this. I'm still trying to pin down those facts myself, since this all just broke, you know, a little over really less than an hour ago.
Right. Right.
So we're all digesting it as we speak.
All right. We're at the end, we're going to swing back around to where you think, what do you think Cuomo is going to end up doing based upon how well you understand this guy from,
sure.
But let's go back. And how did Andrew Cuomo get here, as it were? And by here, I mean, let's say 2 hours ago, because I don't, he's got quite a, I mean, well, it's right there. It's the prince, right? And so I guess his story starts almost with, I guess, the king.
Yeah. So are we talking about getting here in terms of his political career or in terms of the harassment allegations?
No,
all the way back.
I mean, let's go all the way back.
All the way back. Oh, sure. So yeah, I chose the title for my book, The Prince, in part because Andrew Cuomo is very Machiavellian, and also in that he is something of a literal prince because his father was a three-term governor of New York, and in certain circles was very popular. You know, something I talk about in my book is that from a left perspective, Mario is very much overrated and really didn't accomplish very much, and actually was a low key opponent of the left in New York State, which is something that doesn't really get talked about a whole lot. But in my research, I found Mario, like Andrew, would thwart the ambitions of Democrats in the state legislature who are hoping to then take over the state Senate, which would not happen for decades later. So Andrew learns from Mario. Mario becomes governor in 82. Andrew is working for him right out of the gate. You know, Mario ran for mayor in 1977 and nearly won against Ed Koch. Andrew Cuomo at that point was, you know, just out of it, about 19 years old, working on that campaign. So he's someone who's steeped in politics. He's steeped in city and state politics, really learned at his father's knee, and was something of an enforcer for his father. Again, Mario had this reputation as a florid, intellectual, liberal, and, you know, behind the scenes, he was not so much that. And Andrew was really the one who was making the phone calls, making the threats, you know, whipping legislators, telling, you know, the county executives or whoever that you better get in line with Mario's agenda or something bad is going to happen. So that's really those are really Andrew's formative years are learning in the Mario Cuomo government. Mario was governor for 12 years. He ran for a fourth term, was defeated by a Republican, George Pataki, and that, you know, really bothered Andrew and haunted him in some sense. And he was always looking for vindication. And he tried to run against George Pataki in 2002. He dropped out of the Democratic primary to face Pataki, who was a Republican. The campaign was quite disastrous and appeared his political career might be over. I should add, too, thanks to Mario's connections, Andrew also served for a time as HUD secretary in the 1990s under Bill Clinton. So in his 30s, he already was leading a major federal agency, and that would not have been possible without his father, who was close to Bill Clinton. So he's HUD secretary, failed gubernatorial candidate, but he really revives himself in 06. He runs for state attorney general. Now the post that Letitia James has, he wins attorney general, appears he's going to be stuck behind Elliot Spitzer for a long time. Spitzer, of course, has his prostitution scandal, has to resign. And then Cuomo is off to the races from there. The lieutenant governor who took over, David Paterson, was pretty weak and feckless in many ways. It was only a matter of time before Andrew Cuomo pushed him aside, which he did, and really forced Paterson to not run again with the threat of a primary. And then Andrew Cuomo becomes governor in 2010, wins in 2010. And here we are, a decade later, he is still governor of New York.
All right. So a couple of things I want to just go back and I don't know if people, appreciate this about Mario Cuomo. He was very literary and he gave, the modern post runner, I guess, if I would be, you know, Obama's 2004 speech. Mm-hmm. Cuomo gave a version of that at the DNC in the 80s. I think it was 84. And there was a big push. People wanted him to run for president. And it was a huge, like, year long thing. Will he or won't he? Mario Cuomo, like, really built. I mean, it's interesting because the. And like you say, the only thing that Cuomo did really in his tenure of governor in this state was to build a lot of prisons.
Yes.
For the most part. But yet he was able to cultivate this image, not too dissimilar, I think, in the way that Andrew Cuomo did over the past, during that first, 6 months or so of COVID. What's also interesting is that they didn't have a particularly good relationship, even though Andrew was sort of like his, enforcer there, right? I mean, to the extent that you've done any reporting on that, I'm curious about that dynamic because I just remember during, I think it was Andrew Cuomo's birthday, they went to Mario and said, "Do you want to shoot a video for his birthday?" And he was like, "Nah, I'm good." And that story came out publicly, which I thought was weird.
It was a complicated relationship. They were close, but in some ways, there was this tension, almost like they were rivals. And if you read, I had the misfortune of reading not one, but two Andrew Cuomo memoirs. And the thing that strikes you in really both of them is that Andrew can be quite critical of Mario. In Andrew's eyes, Mario was that feckless liberal who didn't get anything done and really was more about rhetoric than action. And Andrew vowed when he was governor, he was going to have concrete accomplishments and really have a much stronger hold on the politics of the state. Mario was much more of a national figure than Andrew Cuomo was until COVID. Before COVID, remember, Andrew Cuomo had middling approval ratings. He was not popular or well-known nationally. He was really not a serious presidential contender or floated as one. You know, 2016, there are a few people going, oh, would Andrew Cuomo run? But really, it was Hillary Clinton's race, and then Bernie ran. There's really not really a space for Andrew in that race. Unlike Mario, which, as you said, Mario was a major figure in the National Party, was really beloved by a lot of liberals around the country, never ran for president. Many people wanted him to. And of course, it was a darker time for liberalism, and the pickings were slim, right? So it was Mario Cuomo, or who exactly, right? Mike Dukakis, Gary Hart, it was not a cornucopia, right, of like great liberal figures at the time. So, Mario benefited from that. But Andrew's read on Mario was that, well-intentioned, but did not deliver. And this was really an obsession of Andrew Cuomo. I think as governor, he has been much more incompetent than the media narrative would suggest. But I will say, in the defense of Andrew Cuomo, he has more concrete accomplishments than his father, who really had none other than building prisons. Quite literally, that's the only physical manifestation of 12 years of Mario Cuomo's governor. There's no great legislation. There were no great social safety net programs that were created. There were no really schools built of any kind. I think some additions to the throughway, things like that. Not much. So Andrew looks at Mario and sees something of a failure and says, I will do better. And part of this obsession with doing better is being a four-term governor. And this is, we come back to today in the sexual harassment allegations. And I just said this, I've said this before, a normal governor in a instance like this, where they've clearly been accused and now we have substantiated evidence, a normal governor would say, well, I've been governor for almost 12 years now. I won't run for re-election next year. Maybe I won't step aside, but my time has come. I'm going to serve out my term and leave. Andrew Cuomo is not a normal governor. He is obsessed with getting the fourth term because his father could not get the fourth term. There's only been one four-term governor in New York State history, Nelson Rockefeller. And Andrew has always wanted to surpass his father and be like a Rockefeller, be like a Robert Moses, a sort of a larger than life figure in the state. And I think he's still thinking this way. We'll see what he says today, later today.
Or he could just go to therapy. That would save us all a lot of hurt in this instance.
He could, but he's in his 60s now. I think that the ship has sailed on introspection.
I guess.
That's probably
it
true.
It seems that way, right?
Well, all right. So he goes to HUD. He's at HUD actually almost for a decade, but not as necessarily as the... I mean, he's at HUD for a while, right?
And yeah, he was the head of HUD for several years in the 90s. Yeah.
And so let's go to how, because I want to lead up into how he was governing, because he got away by just sort of like keeping his head under the radar. I mean, he was really, in many respects, it seems to me, for his first two terms, running like a guy who thinks it's 1993. And trying to avoid having to sign any piece of legislation that is in any way progressive. And we've talked about it quite a bit on this show, but very briefly, just recap, A, the IDC, but also he was cutting taxes massively for corporations and for wealthy people, had a whole scheme, I think this was about 8 years ago now, for property taxes. That would have helped wealthy towns, hurt poorer towns, essentially. Give a sense of his record and in the context also of austerity, because that leads up to some of the problems that we have during COVID.
Sure. So when Andrew Cuomo became governor, he was even more conservative and triangulating than he is now. Andrew Cuomo really ran and won as a 1980s, 1990s style third way Clintonian Democrat, like in every sense. He was anti-labor. He was strongly against raising taxes on the wealthy, very supportive of Republicans having power in the state. He, for most of his tenure, helped Republicans control the state Senate. Democrats did not win a full majority. Now they have a super majority until 2019. So Andrew Cuomo becomes governor in 2011. And what he did was, after the Obama election in 2012, Democrats had the numbers to take the majority in the state Senate. He encouraged and helped push and form this group, the Independent Democratic Conference, that in 2013 broke, they'd already been broken away from the main Democratic Conference, but he encouraged them to form an unprecedented power sharing agreement with the Republicans. So the majority in the state Senate was Republicans and IDC. And the IDC are these conservative, you know, corporate Democrats who, together with the Republicans, formed a majority and locked out the mainstream Democrats from the majority. So what this meant was that in every single budget, every time a bill came to the floor or someone tried to get a bill to the floor, the Republicans would have a say. And so while the Republicans couldn't get their own bills through, generally speaking, because the Democrats still controlled the lower house, the state assembly, what the Republicans could always do was stop progressive legislation, stop bills that would help undocumented immigrants, increase funding for public education, bills to protect abortion rights, bills, I would say, as important as any, to strengthen tenant protections in the state. Again and again, the Republicans could bottle up and block these bills. And someone like Andrew Cuomo very cynically could say, well, I wanted to get this done, but the Republicans won't do it, so not my problem. And he was able to get away with it for a very long time. I mean, this was the reality of New York State, this weird dysfunction and gridlock throughout the 2010s, really until the numbers didn't support it anymore. And progressives took it upon themselves to primary the IDC. There were 8 members of the IDC. 6 of them were beaten in primaries in 2018. And that turned the tide. And finally, in 2019, you got this full Democratic majority. And it grew again in after the 2020 elections. And this is not what Cuomo wanted. He did not want a large left of center majority in the state Senate. And just quickly, sort of on now his current predicament with the sexual harassment allegations, if the assembly brings the impeachment, which, like in Congress, the lower house has to impeach, the Senate convicts, Andrew Cuomo probably does not have the votes in the Senate to survive, I would say, as of right now, if those impeachment allegations get brought, because you have a lot of progressive Democrats who don't like him, and you've got Republicans who'd probably vote to convict too. So he's in a tough place if that impeachment starts. So we can talk about that.
Yes, I want to. And I just also want to cite, you know, the hand of who I refer to as Governor Nixon in helping defeat the IDC, because it really did. I mean, to the extent that there are any progressive accomplishments by Andrew Cuomo, they came out of a concern. First, you had Zephyr Teachout take about 35% from him in a Democratic primary, which was embarrassing to him. I mean, this is a guy who, like you say, he's had deep presidential ambitions. He wants to do what his dad didn't do. And you cannot get less than 60% or 65 or 70% if you're going to be a popular governor who's going to run nationally in a blue state.
With an enormous fundraising disparity, New York has probably the worst campaign finance laws in America. And an incumbent governor or someone running for governor can take a check from a single donor, I think as large as $50,000. It's something bonkers like that. So Cuomo has these huge war chests. Even now he's got $19 million.
That's
insane. He's in danger if he's raising more right now. And then Zephyr still got, about 34, 35% with really less than $1 million. And he was just plowing.
And that, I think that was a big concern for Cuomo, and he really wanted to make sure that Cynthia Nixon would not get anywhere near there. And I think we saw a dramatic change. She also really honed in on the IDC and brought that to the attention of people in a way that most people hadn't been aware of, I think. And so we should just say that. And so And part of it was also the Moreland Commission, which was an independent commission set up to investigate corruption in the state. And as soon as they started coming closer to Andrew Cuomo, he disbanded them. Maybe I want to ask this question. I'll put a pin in it. But how has he gotten away with this on some level, like this level of corruption? But take us to what he did with the public hospitals, because I want to get to specifically to COVID, and then we can get to the sort of the whole media allure around him.
So since the 1990s, there's been this real concerted push to close hospitals in New York State. Some of that is general healthcare trends of consolidation. Some of that is the profit seeking mode of healthcare, where, you know, public hospitals are something like the ugly stepchildren of healthcare because they serve poor people and they don't make money and they're not profitable, right? They are frontline hospitals that help the most vulnerable people in society, the undocumented immigrants and the poor, right? So wealthy people and wealthy interests and, you know, the private hospital lobby, which is very powerful in New York State and very close to the governor, is not so fond of these public hospitals that require a lot, that take these Medicaid patients and don't really, are not able to turn a profit because they take care of the poor and the sick. So under George Pataki, a Republican, there was this big push to close a lot of hospitals and cut Medicaid spending. Andrew Cuomo comes in and really continues that. He's very enthusiastic about cutting Medicaid spending. One of his first acts as governor is to find a way to cut Medicaid spending. He was not able to close as many hospitals as Pataki did, but there were a few key hospitals he shut down that in turn probably could have helped when the pandemic first hit in March of last year. I think of particularly in the Rockaway Peninsula. If people are familiar with Queens, there's a little peninsula out there, and part of it is quite poor and working class. They used to have two hospitals. Andrew Cuomo closed one of their hospitals. Now they're down to one. And the Rockaways was extremely hard hit by COVID in those first 2 months. And a lot of people got sick and died, and the hospital there was overwhelmed. Queens itself, which was an epicenter of the pandemic in those early days, was once a place where there were a lot of hospitals, public and private, and that number just consistently shrank. So Cuomo was not alone in pushing to close hospitals and cut Medicaid spending, but it's a task he took on with enthusiasm once he was governor. And then during the pandemic, he was still trying to cut Medicaid spending to public hospitals, which was something he was trying to do before the pandemic. And he did not change course once COVID was ripping through New York, and it really took a concerted push in the state legislature to stop him from doing that. He's always been sort of obsessed with reining in Medicaid spending in the state, and he still is to an extent. It's just there's been pushback of late.
And you can see in the data, your chances of surviving COVID at least in those first couple of months was directly related to the nature of the hospital that you're headed to. I'm talking in the context of New York. It's all there in the data. Talk about what you think he did wrong in those first couple of months regarding COVID. And this is, you know, there may not be a great example of people who did everything right, but New York, it seems to me, if I'm governor of New York, I'm aware of the fact that New York is not, let's say, Omaha, or it's not even Baltimore. There's a couple of places in America where if there's going to be a pathogen that is somewhere else, New York is going to be one of the first places that is going to get it because of the nature of the city.
Andrew Cuomo did really two things very wrong in those early days, which I talk about a lot in my book, The Prince. The first is downplay the threat of COVID. And this really got memory hold because people associate this solely with Donald Trump. But in February and March of 2020, Andrew Cuomo was comparing COVID to the flu. He was saying that Ebola and SARS were bigger threats. He was saying that the fear was worse than the virus. And he generally was creating this sense of complacency that should not have existed. And as late as mid-March of 2020, he was still likening it to the flu, very much like Republicans and Donald Trump. He was saying, too, that if we test more, we'll see more COVID, and that's why we're seeing more, and there's not really much to worry about. So for a long time, he was really downplaying the virus as it was spreading, and this really was forgotten. And the second part was, he resisted a full shutdown of New York City and New York State, largely because Bill de Blasio suggested it first. Bill de Blasio certainly shares blame in the COVID deaths in New York. To date, New York has the second highest death toll, second highest death per capita in America. So it shows you how horrible it was in those early months that even after all this, New York is still a national leader in that category. And so what happened was in California, in Northern California in particular, there was a successful push in around mid-March to have a coordinated shutdown of the counties around San Francisco and including San Francisco. And Bill de Blasio himself said on around March 17th, it's going to be time for New York City to shut down too. Bill de Blasio didn't have the authority to do this. By this point, all the emergency powers were with the governor. It was Cuomo who could decide when a locality could shut down or not. And he goes on TV and says, nope, we're not going to do that. We can't do a shutdown for New York City. We would have to shut down everywhere. And this is just not going to be done. And really, he resisted the idea, I believe, because he didn't want to be seen as following the mayor in anything. But, 5 days later, New York does announce a shutdown order, which he rebranded New York Pause. So by then, it's around March 22nd or so. COVID has been tearing through the city and state, and a lot of people are getting sick and dying. And you can look at studies from Columbia University and other places that, the sooner you shut down, the sooner you can save lives. Remember, this is well before a vaccine or anything. And the fact that New York took so long to shut down was probably one of the reasons that so many people got sick and died. So I don't blame all of COVID on Cuomo, all deaths on Cuomo. A lot of Republicans do that. I think that's a bit simplistic. COVID was very hard to deal with. Just as I think it's simplistic to only blame Donald Trump for COVID, you see it across the world. It's right. A very tough virus. That being said, Cuomo does not really deserve very much credit because so many people died. It's in the numbers. There's really no way to praise his response when you see 50,000 deaths statewide.
Walk us through the issue of the nursing homes. He decided to basically send patients to nursing homes. There was not, when you cut that many hospitals, you don't have, excess capacity for the event of like something like this. So he decided to use nursing homes. Talk about that decision. But also more, I think, to the point is the decision to cover up that decision, essentially the implications of that decision.
Sure. So there's two parts to it. There was a very controversial directive in March of 2020, as you said, which ordered hospitals to discharge COVID positive patients back to nursing homes where they had come from. And this probably led to the spread of COVID in nursing homes even more so. And Cuomo said he did this because of a fear of a lack of capacity, which was understandable and defensible. But New York had, by this point, set up a lot of these large facilities that went unused that were supposed to handle COVID patients at the Jacob Javits Center in Manhattan, the Tennis Center in Queens. These went largely unfilled. So you could have put COVID patients there from hospitals, but this was not done. Instead, they were sent back to the nursing homes. And the virus obviously was spreading there and killing people. I'll say in Cuomo's defense, this directive was not the sole cause of the COVID problem in nursing homes. The problem was really a challenge for many states and many cities. No one did handle nursing homes well. There was a lack of PPE, a lack of organization. But the bigger issue, I would say, where, you know, the cover up is as much a problem as the crime, and this is sort of where you have your Watergate parallels. Andrew Cuomo and his health department, for reasons that were unclear at the time, and I think now, are purely done to depress the death toll in nursing homes, would not count people who got sick in nursing homes and were transferred to hospitals to die as nursing home deaths. You only counted a nursing home death if they literally died in the nursing home, not if they were a resident for 20 years and got sick and happened to be moved in an ambulance to a hospital. That was not a nursing home death. So what you had is the raw death toll for the state was not impacted. But what you had was this distorted picture of, oh, there's only been, let's say, 1,000 deaths in nursing homes in New York State. I'm making up a number there. When in fact there had been 5,000, 10,000 deaths, right? So the real problem was you had a mishandling, an intentional mishandling of data, and you'd many people in the state legislature, journalists, think tanks demanding the full nursing home death total. He didn't give it until this year when the Attorney General of New York State put out a report and said Cuomo had been distorting and downplaying nursing home deaths. And overnight, the death toll was revised and increased by 50%, I think, in a day or two. And the number went steadily upward as these deaths were counted properly. And the other part of this, and there's a lot to keep track of, I know, was for a long time, nursing homes and hospitals had full legal immunity thanks to the healthcare lobby. And this was inserted into the budget the last minute a year ago, was partially repealed eventually, but was really the strongest, maybe the strongest immunity shield in America, something Mitch McConnell hoped to put into place in Washington. It could not get it, but we got it in New York.
And that part seems to be the real key here, is that this was not just simply an aesthetic decision of like, we don't want people to feel bad about nursing homes. It was there, I believe that Cuomo's people thought this is going to create a potential political force for responsibility for not just the decision, but also liability for these facilities. And the lobby, I suspect it was a function of the lobby basically saying, like, you know, we can't have this type of publicity when we're looking to make sure that we don't have a direct, that we want a shield of liability.
The hospital lobby wrote the immunity shield. The lobbyists literally put that shield together and, you know, had Cuomo get it into the budget last year. So that was a very concerted push on the part of the hospital lobby. And yes, you know, it's in part, you know, it made these facilities, these healthcare facilities, into dumping grounds for COVID patients, right? If you don't fear lawsuits, you feel you can do whatever it is you please. That's a big problem. One of the problems with the immunity shield too was it was so far reaching. It was covering regular non-COVID medical malpractice lawsuits. So if you had a medical malpractice issue in March or April, I think of May of last year, you could not sue. So you can imagine what a boon this was to the healthcare lobby to have this magic immunity shield that covered almost everything. It was really remarkable and terrifying to think about. And it was at the behest of healthcare executives in the state, hospital executives, and of course of Andrew Cuomo and his staff who got it into the budget. You can blame the state legislature too for not fighting back harder at the time. And that was a big part of this. So, you know, you had this striking immunity shield that was protecting a lot of people who are handling the lives of loved ones and perhaps mishandling them, and these families had no legal recourse.
And we should say there's a long history of Cuomo. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is, you know, Ken Langone visits Cuomo's office, and then within days, it's all about charter schools.
from Cuomo. He just adopted this new pet project of increasing charter schools in the state, which also just coincidentally also happened to be Ken Langone's pet project. And so there's this really explicit, it seems to me, relationship between donors' wishes and Andrew Cuomo's that is like particularly naked, it feels like. On some
that might
level.
Have informed his decision to end the corruption investigation a bit early.
That also might have informed, like, yeah, the Moreland Commission. All right, well, so just, I mean, very briefly, let just touch on this thing with de Blasio and then, and the implications of it. And then let's go into, you know, how is it that he's been able to go three terms with the vast majority of New Yorkers seeming oblivious to how bad this guy is. And there is a decent cohort of Republicans out there that hate him because of that one gun control measure.
Right. So the question is, how has he been able to survive so long?
Well, it's not just survive. Like, yeah. I mean, you know, the
and maintain his popularity.
Yeah. I mean, I think, like, you know, you could say,
yeah,
Cuomo was got a C or a C minus in terms of COVID, but his grade from so many people is an A. That's an extraordinary feat, it seems to me.
Yes. Yeah, so you have a few different factors at play. One is purely, why has he been able to be governor for a decade? And I blame New York's horrendous campaign finance laws on that. Cuomo has never faced a primary or general election where his opponent had anywhere near the amount of money he did. No one has been able to ever spend on parity with Cuomo. And that's whether it's Cynthia Nixon, Zephyr Teachout, his Republican opponents, because a candidate for statewide office can accept tens of thousands of dollars per donor and also take LLC and corporate money quite easily. It gives Cuomo a tremendous leg up over rivals because every single special interest in the state wants to funnel tons of money to Cuomo. So he's reaping hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars from the real estate lobby, from the finance lobby, you know, from every single special interest that is any business before the state is giving to Cuomo. So he spent $27 million to beat Cynthia Nixon, who I think spent two, maybe. I mean, that's you're not going to ever win a race spending two against 27 statewide, right? Where you can pound the airwaves, pound TV, radio, you name it, with constant ads. So you start there. Cuomo has never been challenged. Why did he maintain popularity? You know, pre-COVID, the truth was the governor of New York always got a lot less scrutiny than the mayor of New York City. A lot of the media is based in New York City. This has always been my theory, that being in Albany allows you to really hide from view. Andrew Cuomo's top aide, Joe Percoco, was convicted of, you know, on corruption charges and went to prison for a long time. This didn't really make much of a dent in Cuomo's popularity. And I think that's in part because being in Albany, which is a few hours north of the city and where the media is a bit smaller, it really can give you some cover. And I think if Cuomo had been the mayor of New York City and his top aide had gone to prison, it'd be a very different story. So that was sort of the pre-COVID rationale. And then why was he popular during COVID? I mean, I blame the media for a lot of it. Obviously, regular people were scared. They were desperate for foil to Trump. They were desperate for someone to fill the void with facts and some degree of reason. And Trump was so terrible. Andrew Cuomo was there to be a source of comfort. I think if Joe Biden had been president during COVID last year, Andrew Cuomo would not have been so popular. I really believe a lot of it was the Trump effect and this feeling that someone had to stand up to him. And even today, when you talk to people and you explain, well, Cuomo was bad during COVID, but we needed him then because look at what Trump was doing. And they'll just cite 10 things Trump did. So yeah, Trump. And then the media deserves blame. I mean, prestige television stations, CNN, MSNBC, CNN has Chris Cuomo doing softball interviews with Andrew Cuomo.
Ross, let me ask this. Yeah. Do you think it's helpful to have your brother be one of the lead anchors on a national cable television and have you on for interviews that, you know, they're the most challenging thing is like you're the guy who left the cap off the toothpaste.
And the response is, I'm going to give you a wet willy.
Right.
Right.
I mean, that.
I think it helps. Yeah, I think it's a plus to have Chris Cuomo in prime time making weird jokes with you as tens Absolutely. Of thousands of people die in hospitals. Yes.
Also, were I mean, I, like as you say, during that time, people, I guess, forget they were just airing his press conferences from start to finish because, yes. as you say, like. The reason the bar was so low was because Trump was not providing any adequate information and there Nothing. Was mass panic. And so all you had to provide were facts and figures and some sense of, you know, understanding of pandemics baseline. And that's all that was necessary for him to cash in on this multi-million-dollar book deal or whatever the case
you
is.
You know, one man was talking about drinking bleach and the other had PowerPoints and people right. went, oh my God, a PowerPoint. Wow. And people, look, I don't blame ordinary people. I blame the media. Ordinary people were scared. You're sitting at home. You don't know what the heck's going on. We remember those days very well. You know, you are down a rabbit hole of television and social media. That's your world. And here comes Andrew Cuomo into a world, this tough talking guy, also from Queens like Trump, but very different demeanor, has gravitas, has a sense of seriousness about him, which Donald Trump never did. And that was attractive. It Yep. didn't matter because tons of people died, but it was attractive. But then I blame the media because there was so much unnecessary softball coverage. He was on the cover of multiple national magazines. Melissa DeRosa's top aide, who could end up in prison one day for all we know at this point. She was on the cover of Harper's Bazaar. The amount of really over the top coverage of Cuomo and his staff, you know, really contributed to this narrative that he was a hero. He was the COVID conqueror, and he wasn't. COVID was not conquered. Many, many people died, and it was a mass tragedy. The likes of New York has never seen before, and I hope never sees again.
All right, Ross, we just have about a minute or so left sure. here. What do you think happens here? He's going to try and ride this out, and it's an up-in-the-air question as to whether he tries to run again.
Yeah, there are a few roads. Cuomo still has $19 million in the bank. So he's going to look at that amount of money and say, my primary is in June of 2022. I'll ride it out. Come get me. And that's the type of politician he is. Here's where it gets tough for him. The state assembly has the power to impeach him. They've been very scared of doing this. They're a cautious, more moderate body that has not wanted to move against him. Now the report is out. It's quite graphic. There may be a real push to impeach. If that push is significant, Cuomo is in deep, deep trouble because unlike the U.S. Senate, there are votes in the New York State Senate to convict Andrew Cuomo in a trial. There never were the votes to get Trump. There are enough progressive Democrats in the state Senate. There are enough Republicans to put together, I believe it's a 2/3 majority, plus I think judges in the Court of Appeals, to convict and remove him from office. And the question is, does Andrew Cuomo want to go down that road? Is he going to dare the assembly to impeach? We're going to find out.
Ross Barkin, writer of the Substack Political Currents by Ross Barkin, author of The Prince, Andrew Cuomo, Coronavirus, and the Fall of New York. Thank you so much for joining us on what I know is a very busy day for you.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, folks, quick break. We'll be right back to wrap things up. Who are you going to believe? Who are you going to believe? These three women, the state attorney general's office, the investigation that you asked for, or are you going to believe Andrew Cuomo? Yeah. Apparently, he has literally just been at the podium claiming that he didn't do any of it. none of it's true. It's all a lie.
Oh, that's so hard to do when it was the investigation that you called for. And now it's like people are going to see through this. This is a bridge we'll too see. Far. When the investigation comes and it makes, you know, it's
pressure
not the result
for
he likes,
impeachment.
People can see that. Yeah.
If you're watching on Peacock, we will say goodbye and see you tomorrow. And if you are not, we will see you now. And in a moment, we will also see Nomi. Do we have Nomi? Just a reminder, folks, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Your membership helps keep the show chugging along. In fact, it represents somewhere around 91 to 92.3% of our revenue. I haven't done the math in a while. I've never really done the math.
Wait, what is?
The memberships. Yeah.
I don't know, but it seems wrong.
Well, I don't know how to do the math. But it's a big percentage of it. So jointhemajorityreport.com. And also, don't forget, you can get your swag at shop.majorityreportradio.com. Nomi will tell us in a moment who's on her program this week. But first, we go to Matt Leck for the Matt Leckian Media Universe update.
Yeah, we had a patrons-only think tank that released last night, patreon.com/leftreckoning for that. And then tomorrow we're talking about how to sell the Green New Deal, not using that name, in Texas to unions. That will be with Ryan Pollack, IBEW member on Left Reckoning on Wednesday evening.
Nomi!
Hi. You're asking me things I don't know.
Who's on your show?
Well, because we changed the format and we used to do daily. So when I would come on the show, I would know who's on the show the same day. But our show's tomorrow.
Okay.
I know for sure because we're two times a week. So this is me just being a scatterbrained person that I am. Hi.
Where can people find you? Where can people find you?
It's a much easier way of doing it than putting me in the spot. You can find us on patreon.com/thenomikeyshow. We are doing 2 hours, two times a week. So you get, and sometimes a little bit extra because of course we go over. So instead of doing the daily show for 1 hour, we are now doing just as much content, even a little bit more in larger doses, longer interviews, which is surprise what people wanted. Go to patreon.com/thenomikeyshow. Also go to youtube.com/thenomikeyshow. And of course, check out the committee program on Mondays at 3 p.m. on YouTube and all the other places that they post that I don't know off the top of my head. But I do know that Napoleon the Legend's on tomorrow.
Sweet.
Love yeah. We're doing an eviction conversation tomorrow. I just, honestly, I'll look at it tomorrow morning.
All right. Well, we're going to talk more about that in a moment. I'm going to take a quick break. We'll see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
And the alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what? What? Snowflake says what?
bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on! To pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.